This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents Without Merit, a novel by Colleen Hoover, read by Candace Baxton.
Chapter 1. I have an impressive collection of trophies that I did not win. Most of them I purchased from thrift stores or garage sales. Two of them I got from my father for my 17th birthday. Only one of them I stole. My stolen trophy is probably my least favorite one. I took it from Drew Waldrop's bedroom right after he broke up with me. We had been dating 2 months, and it was the first time I allowed him to put his hand all the way up my shirt. I was thinking about how nice it felt when he looked down at me and said, "I don't think I want to date you anymore, Merritt." There I was, enjoying his hand on my boob, and all the while he was thinking of how he never wanted his hand on my boob again. I stoically slid out from under him and stood up. After straightening out my shirt, I walked over to his bookshelf and snatched the biggest trophy he had. He never said a word. I figured if he dumped me with his hand up my shirt, I should at least get a trophy for it. That district championship football trophy was actually the start of my collection. From there, I'd pick up random trophies from garage sales or thrift shops anytime something shitty happened. Fail my driving test? First place in shot put. Don't get asked to junior prom? All-star cast in one-act play. My father proposes to his mistress? Little League team champions. It's been 2 years since I stole that first trophy. I have 12 trophies now, although far more than 12 shitty things have happened to me since Drew Waldrop broke up with me. But it's surprisingly difficult to find unwanted trophies, which is why I'm here at a local antique shop, eyeing the 7th place pageant trophy I've been wanting since I first saw it 6 months ago. It's about a foot and a half tall, and it's from a 1972 Dallas pageant called Boots and Beauties. I like it because of the ridiculous pageant title, but I love it because of the gold-plated woman on top of the trophy. She's wearing a ball gown, a tiara, and a pair of boots with spurs. Everything about it is absurd, especially the $85 price tag, but I've been saving up for it since I first laid eyes on it, and I finally have enough money to purchase it. I grab the trophy and turn to walk toward the register when I notice a guy on the 2nd floor of the antique store. He's leaning over the railing, staring at me. His chin is resting casually in one of his hands like he's been in that position for a while. He smiles as soon as we make eye contact. I smile back, which is a bit out of character for me. I'm not the type to flirt, and I'm definitely not the type to know how to reciprocate when someone flirts with me. But his smile is pleasant, and he isn't even on the same floor as me, so I don't feel threatened by potential embarrassment.
"What are you doing?" he calls out.
Naturally, I look over my shoulder to see if he's directing his comment at me. Maybe the guy isn't looking at me and he's talking to someone behind me, but other than a mother who braved the antique store with her little boy, there isn't anyone else in my vicinity. And the woman and her child are both facing the opposite direction, so he must be referring to me. I look back up at him and he's still looking down at me with that smile.
"I'm buying a trophy."
I think I might like his smile, but he's a little too far away for me to tell if I'd be attracted to him. His confidence is attractive in itself. He has dark hair, and it's a bit choppy and spastic, but I'm not judging because I don't think I've brushed my own hair since yesterday morning. He's wearing a gray hoodie with the sleeves shoved above his elbows. Tattoos cover the arm his chin is resting on, but I can't make them out from down here. From here, he looks a little too young and a little too tattooed to be browsing for antiques on a random weekday morning.
But who am I to judge? I should be in school right now. I turn around and pretend to shop, but I'm aware that he's watching me. I try to ignore it, but every now and then I'll glance back up at him to make sure he's still there. He is. Maybe he works here, and that's why he's lingering, but it wouldn't explain why he won't stop staring at me. If this is his idea of flirting, it's a strange way to flirt. But sadly, I'm attracted to unconventional and strange. So the entire time I browse the store, I force myself to seem unaffected, when in reality, I'm very affected. I can feel his stare with every step I take. Stares shouldn't have weight, but knowing his eyes are on me makes my steps feel heavier. It even makes my stomach feel heavier. I've already looked at everything in the store, but I don't want to check out yet and leave because I'm enjoying this game too much. I attend a very small public school in a very small town, and when I say small, I'm being generous. There is an average of 20 kids in each grade. Not class. Grade. My entire senior class consists of 22 students, 12 girls and 10 guys. 8 of those 10 guys have been in class with me since I was 5. That narrows the dating field quite a bit. It's hard to find someone attractive that you've spent almost every day of your life with since you were 5 years old. But I have no idea who this guy is that's made me the center of his attention, which means I'm already more attracted to him than any person in my entire school, simply because I don't know him. I pause on an aisle that's clearly visible from where he's standing, and I pretend to be interested in one of the signs displayed on the shelf. It's an old white sign with the word "shaft" written on it, and an arrow pointing to the right. It makes me laugh. Next to it is an old sign that looks to be from a gas station. It says lubricant. It makes me wonder if someone placed the sexually suggestive signs together, or if it was random. If I had enough money, I'd buy them and start a sexually suggestive sign collection for my bedroom. But my trophy habit is expensive enough. The little boy who has been browsing the store with his mother is standing a couple of feet away from me now. He looks to be about 4 or 5 years old, the same age as my little brother, Moby. His mother has told him no less than 10 times not to touch anything, but he picks up the glass pig sitting on the shelf in front of us. Why are kids so drawn to fragile things? His eyes are bright as he inspects it. I appreciate that his curiosity is more important to him than following his mother's orders. "Mom, can I have this?" His mother is an aisle over, digging through a rack of old magazines. She doesn't even turn around to look at what he's holding. She just says, "No." The boy's eyes dim immediately, and he frowns as he goes to set the pig back on the shelf, but his little hands fumble when he tries to set it down, and the pig slips from his grasp, shattering at his feet. "Don't move," I say to him, reaching him before his mother does. I bend down and start picking up the pieces. His mother plucks him up and sets him a few feet away so that he's out of reach of the glass. "I told you not to touch anything, Nate." I glance over at the little boy, and he's staring at the broken glass like he just lost his best friend. His mother presses her hand to her forehead like she's exhausted and frustrated, and then bends down and starts helping me pick up the pieces. "He didn't do it," I say to her. "I'm the one who broke it." The woman looks back at her little boy, and her little boy looks at me like he doesn't know if this is a test. I wink at him before she turns back around, and I say, "I didn't see him standing there. I bumped into him and dropped it." She looks surprised and maybe even a bit guilty for assuming her son did it. "Oh," she says. She continues to help me pick up the larger shards of glass. The man who was standing at the register when I walked in appears out of nowhere with a broom and a dustpan. "I'll take it from here," he says. But then he points to a sign on the wall that reads, "You break it, you buy it." The woman takes her little boy's hand and walks away. The little boy glances over his shoulder and smiles at me, and it makes taking the blame so worth it. I return my attention to the man with the broom. How much was it?
$49. I'll only charge you $30, though.
I sigh. I'm not so sure that little boy's smile is worth $30. I walk my pageant trophy back to its home and pluck a much cheaper, much less appealing trophy from the shelf. I take it to the register and pay for the shattered pig and my first-place bowling trophy. When the man hands me the sack and my change, I head toward the door. Right when I go to push it open, I remember the guy who was watching me from the second-floor railing. I glance up before I walk out the door, but he's no longer there. Somehow this makes me feel even heavier. I walk out of the store and cross the street, heading for one of the tables near the fountain. I've lived in Hopkins County my whole life, but I rarely make it down to the square. I don't know why, because my love for it was solidified when they put up the strange crosswalk signs. The signs display a picture of a man crossing the street, but his leg is lifted high in the air, and it's exaggerated to the point that it could pass as a silly walk out of a Monty Python show. There are also two bathrooms the city had installed a few years back. They're two glass structures that look like a tall cube of mirrors from the outside, but when you're inside the bathrooms, you can see out. It's disturbing that a person can be sitting on the toilet doing their business while watching cars drive by, but I'm drawn to unusual things, so I'm one of the few who probably take pride in the strange bathrooms.
Who's the trophy for?
Speaking of being drawn to unusual things, the guy from the antique store is standing next to me now, and I can say with complete certainty that he is most definitely attractive. His eyes are a unique shade of light blue, so they're the first thing to stand out. They seem out of sync with his olive skin and severely dark hair. I stare at his hair a moment. I'm not sure I've ever seen hair that color of black on someone with eyes that color of blue. It's a bit jarring. For me, anyway. He's still smiling at me just like he was from the railing in the antique store. It makes me wonder if he smiles all the time. I hope not. I like the thought that maybe he's smiling at me because he can't help it. He nudges his head toward the sack in my hand, and I suddenly remember he asked me a question about the trophy.
Oh, it's for me.
He tilts his head in amusement or wonder. I don't really know which one he's feeling, but I'm fine with either.
You collect trophies you didn't win?
I nod, and it makes him laugh a little, but it's a silent laugh, almost like he wants to keep it to himself. He slides his hands in his back pockets.
Why aren't you in school right now?
I didn't realize it was that obvious that I'm still in high school. I drop my sack on the table next to us and slip off my sandals.
It's a nice day. I didn't want to be locked in a classroom.
I walk over to the concrete fountain that really isn't a fountain at all. It's a section of concrete, flat on the ground in the shape of a star. The water comes out of holes around the star and spits toward the center. I press my foot over one of the holes and wait for the water to reach me. It's the last week of October, so it's too cold for kids to be playing in the water like they usually are in the summer, but it isn't too cold to get my feet a little wet. I like it when the water hits the bottom of my feet, and since I can't afford to get a pedicure, it's the next best thing. The guy watches me for a moment, but honestly, I'm getting used to it. He's starting to feel like my own personal, slightly more attractive shadow. I don't look directly at him as he casually slips off his shoes. He stands next to me and presses one of his feet over the holes. I glance at his arm now to get a closer look at the tattoos. I was right. They're only on his left arm. His right arm doesn't have a single visible tattoo on it, but the tattoos on his left arm aren't what I expected. They're random and unrelated, and none of them connect. One of them is a tiny toaster with one slice of bread sticking out of it. It's on the outside of his wrist. I can see a safety pin near his elbow. The words, "Your turn, doctor," are sprawled across his forearm.
I drag my eyes up his arm and he's looking down at his feet now. I'm about to ask him his name when the water hits my foot unexpectedly. I laugh and step back, and we both watch the spout of water shoot toward the center. The water hits his foot next, but he doesn't react to it. He just stares down at his feet until the water stops and moves on to the hole next to him. He lifts his eyes, but when he looks at me this time, he isn't smiling. Something about the seriousness in his expression makes everything tighten inside my chest. When he opens his mouth to speak, I hang on to every word. Out of all the places we could be, we're right here, at the same time. His voice is laced with amusement, but his expression verges on bewildered. He shakes his head and steps closer to me. He reaches his tattooed arm up and slides his fingers down a strand of my hair that's come loose. The gesture is intimate and unexpected, kind of like this whole moment, but I'm more than okay with it. I want him to do it again, but his arm falls back to his side. I can't think of a single instance where I've ever been looked at like he's looking at me right now. Like I fascinate him. I know we don't know each other at all, and whatever this connection is between us will probably be ruined the minute we have our first real conversation. He'll probably be a douchebag, or he'll think I'm weird, and then it'll get awkward, and we'll be more than happy to go our separate ways. That's how my interactions with guys usually go. But right now, in this moment, knowing nothing about him other than the intensity in his expression, it allows me to imagine he's perfect. I pretend he's smart and respectful and funny and artistic, because he would be all those things if he were the perfect guy. I'm content with imagining he possesses these qualities for as long as he's going to stand here in front of me. He takes a step closer to me, and it suddenly feels like I've swallowed his heart because I have all these extra beats in my chest. His eyes drop to my mouth, and I'm certain he's about to kiss me. I hope he is, which is odd because I've literally only spoken a couple of sentences to him, but I want him to kiss me while I'm imagining him to be perfect, because that means his kiss would probably be perfect, too. His fingers feather up my wrist, but it feels more like he has both fists clasped tightly around my lungs. My chills chase his fingers up my arm until his hand is resting against my neck. I don't know how I'm still standing with the unreliable legs I seem to have right now. My head is tilted back and his mouth is inches from mine, as if he's hesitating. He smiles and whispers, "You bury me." I have no idea what those words mean, but I like them. And I like how his lips connect softly with mine right after he finishes saying whatever it was he just said. And I was right. It's perfect. So perfect it feels like the old days in the movie, when the male lead would press his hand against the woman's back, and she would curve her body backward against the pressure of his kiss like the letter C, while he pulls her against him. It's just like that. He's pulling me to him when his tongue slides across my lips, and just like in the movies, my arms are dangling at my sides until I realize how much I want to be in this with him and finally begin to kiss him back. He tastes like mint ice cream, and it's perfect because this moment ranks high on my scale of favorites, right up there with dessert. This is almost comical, this stranger kissing me as if it were the last thing left on his bucket list. It makes me wonder what compelled him to do this. Both of his hands move to hold my face now like we have nowhere else to be today. He's not in a hurry with his kiss, and he definitely doesn't care who sees this because we're in the middle of the town square and two people have already honked at us. I wrap one of my arms around his neck and decide I'll just let him continue for as long as he wants because I don't have anywhere to be right now. Even if I did, I'd cancel my plans in exchange for this. Right when one of his hands slides through my hair, the water splashes beneath my feet. I squeal a little because it's unexpected. He laughs, but he doesn't stop kissing me. Now we're being soaked because my foot isn't covering the spout all the way, but neither of us cares.
It just adds to the ridiculousness of this kiss. The ringtone on his phone adds even more ridiculousness to the moment, because of course we'd be interrupted right now. Of course. It was way too perfect. He pulls back, and the look in his eye is somehow satiated and starving at the same time. He pulls his phone out of his pocket and looks down at it.
Did you lose your phone, or is this a joke?
I shrug because I have no idea which part of this he thinks might be a joke. Me allowing him to kiss me? Someone calling him in the middle of said kiss? He laughs a little as he presses the phone against his ear.
Hello?
The smile leaves his expression, and now he just looks confused.
Who is this?
He waits a couple of seconds and then pulls the phone away from his ear and looks down at it. Then he looks up at me.
Seriously, is this a prank?
I don't know if he's talking to me or the person on the phone, so I shrug again. He puts the phone to his ear and takes a step away from me.
Who is this?
He repeats. He laughs nervously and grips the back of his neck.
But you're standing right in front of me.
I can feel the color drain from my face at that sentence. All the color in my body, in this ridiculous moment with this random guy, pools at my feet, leaving me feeling like the second-rate carbon copy of Honor Voss, my twin sister. The girl who is obviously on the other end of that phone call. I cover my face with my hand and turn around, grabbing my shoes and my sack. I hope I can put as much distance between us as possible before he figures out that the girl he just kissed isn't Honor. I can't believe this is happening. I just kissed my sister's boyfriend. I didn't do it on purpose, obviously. I had a feeling she had just recently started seeing someone because she's been gone a lot. But out of all the guys in the world, how was I supposed to know this particular guy was him? I continue to rush away, but I can't get far enough before I hear him running after me.
Hey!
He calls out. This is why he was watching me in the store. He thought I was her. It's why he asked why I wasn't in school, because if he knows Honor well enough to kiss her, he knows Honor would never skip school. It all makes sense now. This wasn't some random connection between two strangers. This was him mistaking me for his girlfriend, and me being a complete fool for not immediately realizing what was happening. I feel his hand grip my elbow. I have no choice but to turn and face him because I need to make it clear that Honor can never find out about this. When our eyes meet, he's no longer looking at me like I fascinate him. He's staring at his phone, and then me, and then his phone, and then...
I am so sorry,
he says.
I thought you were...
You thought wrong. I snap, even though it was an honest mistake. Honor and I are identical, but if he knew my twin sister at all, he should know she would never be caught dead in public looking like I look right now. I'm not wearing makeup. My hair is a mess, and my clothes are left over from yesterday. He slides his phone back in his pocket, but it begins to ring again. When he pulls it out, I can see Honor's name flashing across the screen. I grab his phone and swipe my finger across the screen.
Hey.
Merritt, Honor laughs.
What's going on? Why are you with Sagan?
Sagan. Even his name is perfect.
I'm not. I just bumped into him. He thought I was you, but then you called, and let's just say he was confused.
I say all this while staring directly at Sagan. He keeps his eyes locked on mine and doesn't even try to take the phone away from me. Honor laughs again.
That's funny. I wish I could have seen his face.
It was priceless, I deadpan. But you should know to warn your boyfriend that you have an identical twin. I hand the phone back to Sagan. I back away a few steps, and he's holding the phone in his hand, unable to take his eyes off me. Do not repeat what just happened to her, I whisper. To anyone, ever. He nods, albeit hesitantly. As soon as I have confirmation that he won't repeat this to Honor, I turn and walk away. Nothing could ever top this level of embarrassment. Nothing.
Chapter 2.
I am such a fool. But God, it was so beautifully unexpected. His intensity caught me off guard, but the second he kissed me, I was a goner. He tasted like mint, and he was so warm, and then the water was splashing us, and it was a sensory overload that I wanted to be an overdose. I wanted it all. I wanted to feel everything. That unexpected kiss made me feel alive for the first time, and actually, I'm not sure I've ever felt that way. Which is exactly why I didn't come to the realization that he thought he was kissing Honor. While that random kiss meant a lot to me, it was nothing new to him. He probably kisses Honor like that all the time. Which is confusing, because he seemed to be healthy. Not Honor's type, normally. Speaking of Honor, I turn on my blinker and reach for my phone on the second ring. It's odd that she's calling me. We never call each other. When I come to the stop sign, I answer it with a lazy, "Hey, are you still with Sagan?" Honor asks. I close my eyes and release a tiny bit of air. I don't have much to spare after that kiss back there. "No." She sighs. "Weird, he's not answering his phone now. I'll try calling him back." "Okay." I'm about to hang up when she says, "Hey, why aren't you in school right now?" I sigh. "Wasn't feeling well, so I left." "Oh, okay. See you tonight." "On her way," I say before she ends the call. Is something wrong with Sagan?" "What do you mean?" "You know, are you with him because... is he dying?" It's quiet for a moment, but then I can hear the irritation in her voice when she says, "Jesus, Merritt, of course not. You can be a real bitch sometimes." The line goes dead. I look down at the phone. I wasn't trying to insult her. I'm genuinely curious if that's why she's dating him. She hasn't had a single boyfriend with an average lifespan since she started dating Kirk at 13. She's still heartbroken over the way that relationship left her feeling like she was choking on scar tissue. Kirk was a nice farm boy. He drove a tractor, baled hay, knew how to flip an electrical breaker, and once fixed the transmission of a car that my father couldn't even fix himself. About a month before we turned 15 and 2 weeks after Honor lost her virginity to Kirk, his father found Kirk lying on the ground in the middle of their pasture, semi-conscious and bleeding. Kirk had fallen off the tractor, which ran over him, injuring his right arm. Although the injury wasn't life-threatening, while receiving treatment for the injury, the erudite doctor sought answers as to why Kirk might have fallen off the tractor to begin with. Turns out, Kirk had suffered a seizure as the result of a tumor that had been growing in his brain. "Possibly since infancy," said the doctor. Kirk lived 3 more months. The entire 3 months he lived, my sister rarely left his side. Honor was the first and last girl he loved, and the last person Kirk saw before taking his final breath. Honor developed an unhealthy affliction as a result of her first love dying from a tumor that had been growing in his brain, possibly since infancy. Honor found it almost impossible to love any boy after who was of average health and normal lifespan. She spends most days and nights in online chat rooms for the terminally ill, falling madly in love with boys who have an average life expectancy of 6 months or less. Although our town is a bit too small to provide Honor with an ample supply of ailing suitors, Dallas is less than a 2-hour drive away. With the number of hospitals devoted to terminal illnesses, at least 2 boys have been within driving distance to Honor. During their last few weeks on Earth, Honor spent the remaining days by their sides, determined to be the last person they saw and the last girl they loved before taking their final breaths.
Because of her obsession with being loved eternally by the terminally ill, I'm curious what has drawn her to this Sagan guy. Based on her relationship history, I think it's fair of me to have assumed he was terminally ill, but apparently that assumption makes me a bitch. I pull into my driveway, relieved I'm the only one here, if you don't count the permanent resident in the basement. I grab my sack with the trophy in it. Had I known at the antique store that I was about to experience the most humiliating event in all my 17 years, I would have bought every trophy they had. I would have had to use Dad's emergency credit card, but it would have been well worth it. I glance at the marquee as I make my way across the yard. A day hasn't passed since we moved in that my brother, Utah, hasn't updated the marquee with the same promptness and precision that he gives to every other aspect of his life. He wakes at approximately 6:20 a.m. every day, showers at 6:30 a.m., makes 2 green smoothies, one for him and one for Honor, at 6:55 every morning, if she doesn't have them made first. By 7:10, he's dressed and headed to the marquee to update the daily message. At approximately 7:30 every morning, he gives our little brother an annoying pep talk, and then he leaves for school. Or, if it's a weekend, he heads to the gym to work out, where he walks for 45 minutes at a level 5 on the treadmill, followed by 100 push-ups and 200 sit-ups. Utah doesn't like spontaneity. Despite the common phrase, Utah does not expect the unexpected. He expects only the expected. He does not like the unexpected. He didn't like it when our parents divorced several years ago. He didn't like it when our father remarried. And he especially didn't like it when we were told our new stepmother was pregnant. But he does, in fact, like our half-brother that came as a result of said pregnancy. Moby Voss is hard not to like. Not because of his personality, per se, but because he's 4. 4-year-old children are fairly liked across the board. Today, the message on the marquee reads, "You can't hum while holding your nose closed." It's true. I tried it when I read it this morning, and I even try it again as I walk toward the double cedar front doors of our house. I can say with certainty that we live in the most unusual house in this whole town. I say house because it is certainly not a home, and inside this house are 7 of the most unusual occupants. No one would be able to determine from the outside of our house that our family of 7 includes an atheist, a homewrecker, an ex-wife suffering from a severe case of agoraphobia, and a teenage girl whose weird obsession borders on necrophilia. No one would be able to determine any of that from inside our house either. We're good at keeping secrets in this family. Our house is located just off an oil-top county road in a microscopic northeast Texas town. The building we live in was once the highest-attended church in our tiny town, but it's been our house since my father, Barnaby Voss, purchased the fledgling church and closed its doors to the patrons indefinitely. Which explains why we have a marquee in our front yard. My father is an atheist, although that isn't at all why he chose to purchase the foreclosed house of worship and rip it from the hands of the people. No, God had no say in the matter. He bought the church and closed the doors simply because he absolutely, vehemently, without doubt, hated Pastor Brian's dog, and subsequently Pastor Brian. Wolfgang was a massive black lab who was impressive in size and bark, but lacked a great deal of common sense. If dogs were classified into high school cliques, Wolfgang would most definitely be head of the jocks. A loud, obnoxious dog that spent at least 7 of the 8 precious hours of sleep my father needed each night, barking incessantly. Years ago, we had the unfortunate distinction of being Wolfgang's neighbor when we lived in the house behind the church. My parents' bedroom window overlooked the back property of the church, which also doubled as Wolfgang's stomping grounds, in which he stomped quite regularly, mostly during the hours my father would rather Wolfgang have been sleeping. But Wolfgang didn't like to be told what to do or when to sleep,
In fact, he did the exact opposite of what anyone wanted him to do. Pastor Brian had purchased Wolfgang when he was just a pup, not a week after a group of local teens broke into his church and stole the week's tithe. Pastor Brian felt that a dog on the premises would deter future robberies. However, Pastor Brian knew very little in the way of training a dog, much less a dog with the intellect of a high school football jock. So the first year of Wolfgang's existence, the dog had very little interaction with humans outside of his master. Being that Wolfgang got the short end of the stick when it came to intellect and interaction, all of his boundless energy and curiosity were placed solely on the unsuspecting and possibly undeserving victim who occupied the property directly behind the church. My father, Barnaby Voss. My father had not been a fan of Wolfgang since the moment they became acquainted. He prohibited me and my siblings from interacting with the dog, and it was not uncommon for us to overhear my father threatening to murder Wolfgang under his breath, and at the top of his lungs. My father may not be a believer in the Lord, but he is an avid believer in karma. As much as he fantasized about murdering Wolfgang, he did not want the murder of an animal hanging over his head, even if that animal was the worst he'd ever encountered. Wolfgang's feelings were mutual. Or so it was assumed by the way Wolfgang spent the better part of his life barking and growling at my father, inconsiderate to whether it was day or night or weeknight or weekend, only occasionally distracted by a rogue squirrel. Dad tried everything over the years to put an end to the incessant harassment, from earplugs to cease and desist warnings, barking right back at Wolfgang for 3 hours straight after a Friday evening of consuming 3 glasses more than his usual evening glass of wine. He attempted all of these things to no avail. In fact, my father was so desperate for a peaceful night's sleep, he once spent an entire summer attempting to befriend Wolfgang in hopes that the barking would eventually cease. It didn't. Nothing worked. And from the looks of it, nothing would ever work, because Pastor Brian cared for Wolfgang a significant deal more than he cared for his neighbor Barnaby Voss. Unfortunately for Pastor Brian, his fledgling church was at an all-time financial low, while my father's used car lot and thirst for revenge were at an all-time high. My father made a bid the bank couldn't refuse, and one Pastor Brian could not himself raise the funds to match. It helped that my father also threw in quite a deal on a used Volvo for the loan officer in charge of the church's foreclosure. When Pastor Brian announced to his congregation that he'd lost a bidding war to my father, and that my father would be closing the doors to the public and moving our entire family into the church, our family became fodder for gossip, and it hasn't subsided since. After signing the closing papers almost 5 years ago, my father gave Pastor Brian and Wolfgang 2 days to vacate the premises. It took them 3. But on the 4th night, after our family moved into the church, my father slept 13 hours straight. Pastor Brian was forced to relocate his Sunday sermons, but with divine intervention on his side, it took no more than just 1 day to find an alternate venue. He reopened a week later in an upscale barn that was used by a deacon to house his collection of tractors. For the first 3 months, the parishioners sat on bales of hay while Pastor Brian preached his sermon from a makeshift platform constructed out of plywood and pallets. For 6 solid months, Pastor Brian made it his personal mission to publicly pray for my father and his wayward soul every Sunday before dismissing church. "May he see the error of his ways," Pastor Brian and the parishioners would say, "and return us to our house of worship at an affordable price." This news of being at the top of Pastor Brian's prayer list was unsettling to my father, for he did not feel he had a soul, much less a wayward soul. He certainly did not want the churchgoers praying for said soul. Approximately 7 months after we turned that old church into our family dwelling, Pastor Brian was seen driving a brand-new-to-him Cadillac convertible. The following Sunday, Barnaby Voss was coincidentally no longer a subject in Pastor Brian's passive-aggressive closing prayer. I was at the car lot the day my father and Pastor Brian worked out the deal. I was significantly younger than I am now, but I remember the deal as if it were yesterday.
You stop praying for my non-existent soul and I'll knock $2,000 off that cherry red Cadillac.
It's been several years since any of us had to listen to Wolfgang bark at night, and several years since my father has greeted a morning in a foul mood. Our family has done a great deal of remodeling inside the church, but there are still three elements that prevent the dwelling from feeling unlike the house of worship it once was. 1. The stained glass windows. 2. The 8-foot-tall statue of Jesus Christ hanging on the east wall. 3. The church marquee on the front lawn. The same marquee that remains out front all these years later, long after my father changed the name atop the marquee from Crossroads Lutheran Church to Dollar Voss. He chose to name the house Dollar Voss because the church is divided into 4 quarters, and our last name is Voss. I wish there were a more intelligent explanation. I open the front doors and walk into quarter 1. It consists of the old chapel-turned-living area and a rather large kitchen, both remodeled to reflect their new uses, save the 8-foot-tall statue of Jesus Christ on a cross still hanging on the east wall of the living room. Utah and my father worked tirelessly one summer to dismount the 8-foot-tall statue to no avail. It appeared, after days of failed attempts to remove him from the living room wall, that Jesus Christ's cross was an actual part of the structure of the building and could not be removed without also removing the studs and the entire east wall of the house. My father didn't like the idea of losing an entire wall. He enjoys the outdoors, but he is a big believer that the indoors and the outdoors should remain segregated. Instead, he made the decision that the 8-foot-tall Jesus Christ would have to remain.
"It gives quarter 1 a little character," he said.
He's an atheist, which means the wall hanging is just that, and nothing more to him. A wall hanging where an 8-foot-tall Jesus is the focal point. Nonetheless, I make it a point to ensure Jesus Christ is dressed to reflect the appropriate holiday, which is why the 8-foot-tall statue of Jesus Christ is currently covered in a white bedsheet. He's dressed as a ghost. Quarter 2, which at one time consisted of 3 Sunday school classrooms, has since had walls added and is now divided into 6 rather small bedrooms, large enough to contain 1 child, 1 twin-sized bed, and 1 dresser. My 3 siblings and I occupy 4 of the 6 bedrooms. The 5th bedroom is a guest room, and the 6th bedroom is used as my father's office, which I've never actually once seen him use. Quarter 3 is the old dining hall turned master bedroom. It's where my father sleeps soundly for at least 8 hours every night with Victoria Finney Voss. Victoria has lived in Dollar Voss for approximately 4 years and 2 months. 3 months prior to the finalization of my father's divorce from my mother, and 6 months prior to the birth of my father's 4th, and hopefully final child, Moby. The last quarter of Dollar Voss, quarter 4, is the most secluded and controversial of the 4 quarters. The basement. It is set up much like an efficiency apartment, consisting of a bathroom with a standing shower, a very mini kitchen, and a small living area containing 1 couch, 1 television, and 1 full-sized bed. My mother, Victoria Voss, not to be confused with my father's current wife of the same name, occupies quarter 4. It is unfortunate that my father divorced 1 Victoria only to immediately marry another, but not nearly as unfortunate as the fact that both Victorias still live in Dollar Voss. My father's love for the current Victoria Voss was not so much a rebound relationship, but rather more of an overlap, which is the major source of contention remaining among the 3 adults. It's rare that my mother, Vicky, ascends from her dwellings in quarter 4, but her presence is felt by all. Although none are quite as sensitive to the current living arrangement as my father's current wife, Victoria. She hasn't been happy about my mother's occupancy of quarter four since the day she moved in to Dollar Voss. I'm sure it's difficult having to live in a house with your husband and his ex-wife, but probably not nearly as difficult as it was for my cancer-ridden mother to find out my father was sleeping with her oncology nurse. But that was several years ago, and my siblings and I have long since moved past the wrongs our father committed against our mother. Actually, we haven't. Not even slightly. Regardless, it's taken all of the last several years for Dollar Voss to be remodeled and revamped to appropriately house the entire Voss family. But my father is patient, if anything. Despite what is true, we, the Voss family, look very much like a normal family, and Dollar Voss looks very much like a normal house, save the stained glass windows, the statue on our wall, and the church marquee. Pastor Brian faithfully updated the marquee every Saturday with clever phrases such as, "Don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out," and "This week's sermon, 50 Shades of Prey." Sometimes I wonder what the townspeople think when they drive by and read Utah's daily facts and quotes. Like yesterday when the marquee read, "The face of the Nobel Peace Prize medal is a depiction of three naked men." I occasionally think it's funny, but I'm mostly just embarrassed. Most of the residents of our small town already feel we're out of place here, living in this old church. Our actions only prove to reinforce those feelings. I think my father actually tried to make an effort to fit in last year and make our house look more like a home than a church. He spent 2 weeks putting up a cute white picket fence around our entire yard. The white picket fence didn't do much to make it look more like a home. Now it just looks like we live in an old church surrounded by an out-of-place white picket fence. A plus for effort, though. I go to my bedroom and close the door. I toss my sack on the floor by my bed and plop down onto my mattress. It's almost 3 p.m, which means Moby and Victoria will be back soon, then Honor in Utah, then my father, then family dinner. Joy. Today has already been too much. I'm not sure I can take much more. I go to the bathroom and search the drawers for some sleep medicine. I don't normally take it unless I'm sick, but the only thing I can think of that will get me through tonight without obsessing over my kiss with Honor's boyfriend is a few sips of NyQuil, which is precisely what I find under the sink. I take a dose and then text my father when I'm back in my room and under the covers. I'm not feeling well. Left school early and going to bed. We'll probably miss dinner. I turn the sound off on my phone and slide it under my pillow. I close my eyes, but it doesn't help me to stop seeing Sagan in front of me. Honor and I aren't as close as we used to be, so it's not unusual that I didn't know about her new fling. I have noticed she's been gone more than usual, but I haven't asked her why. As far as I know, she's never brought him to our house, so I had no idea who he was when I saw him today. If only I had seen his face prior to the incident on the town square, that whole embarrassment could have been avoided. I would have known who he was immediately. If he has even one decent bone in his body, he'll break it off with her and never step foot inside this house. It's not like they're in love. They barely know each other. It's only been a couple of weeks. Anyone in their right mind wouldn't want to come between sisters, especially twins. But then again, I doubt he has any intentions to pursue me at all. It was an honest mistake. He thought I was Honor. If he had known I was her sister, he never would have said sickeningly sweet and confusing things like, "You bury me," right before sticking his tongue down my throat. He's probably laughing about the mix-up. Hell, he probably ended up telling Honor what happened, and they're both laughing about it. Laughing about poor, pathetic Merritt, who thought the cute guy was actually into her. I hate that I'm so embarrassed by it. I should have slapped him when he kissed me. Had I done that, I would be laughing about it with him, but instead I threw myself at him and consumed as much of that kiss and him as I possibly could. It's a feeling I want to experience again, and that's what has me the most upset.
The last thing I want is for there to be something of my sister's that I'm envious of. Just thinking about Sagan kissing her like he kissed me today makes me so jealous I would bleed green if someone stabbed me. I've always feared something like this would happen. That someone would assume I was her, and I would embarrass myself somehow. Really, the only thing that sets us apart is that she wears contacts and I don't. It doesn't matter that I've done all I can to differentiate myself from Honor, including cutting and dyeing my hair, starving myself, and overeating. But we always seem to weigh the same, look the same, sound the same. But we are not the same. I'm nothing like my identical twin sister, who prefers cadaver hearts to fully functioning ones. I am nothing like my father, Barnaby, who has turned our entire lives upside down simply out of spite for a canine. I am certainly nothing like my brother, Utah, who spends every waking moment living an externally precise, perfect, and punctual present to make up for all the internal imperfections that live in his past. And I am absolutely, without a doubt, a far cry from my mother, Vicky, who spends her days and nights in quarter four watching Netflix, licking the salt off potato chips, living off disability, refusing to vacate the house where her ex-husband and newer wife, Victoria, continue to live their lives upstairs, primarily in quarters one and three. The NyQuil begins to kick in as soon as I hear the front door open. Moby's voice carries down the hallway, and Victoria's voice soon follows as she calls after him to go wash his hands before he eats a snack. I reach to my nightstand and grab my headphones. I'd much rather fall asleep listening to C-Fret than to the sound of my family right now.
Chapter 3. I was hoping I'd never see Sagan again. I was hoping they'd break it off before she brought him around the family for introductions. That hope lasted 24 hours until it was diminished. And it's been diminished for almost 2 weeks now. In that 2 weeks, Sagan has been at our house more times than I can count. He's here for dinner every night, for breakfast every morning, and most hours in between. I haven't spoken a single word to him since the morning he showed up at our house for the first time, a mere 24 hours after his tongue was down my throat. I walked out of my bedroom, still in my pajamas, and saw him sitting at the table. As soon as we made eye contact, I spun around and opened the refrigerator. I felt like my heart was a pinball bouncing around inside my chest. I managed to make it through breakfast that morning without uttering a single word. Once everyone started to gather their things and leave, I breathed a small sigh of relief until I realized he was still in the kitchen and didn't look like he was leaving, like everyone else. I heard Honor tell him goodbye. I wasn't facing them, so it made me wonder if they kissed goodbye. I didn't wonder enough to turn around and witness it, though. I was curious why he wasn't walking out with her. It was a bit odd that he'd linger in a house he wasn't acquainted with after his girlfriend left for school, but that's exactly what he did. Once everyone was gone but him, I grabbed a rag to wipe down the counter. It didn't need cleaning, but I didn't know what else to do with my hands or my eyes. He stood up and picked up the 3 glasses left behind on the table. He walked them into the kitchen and stood next to me while he poured the contents in the sink. There was such a heavy silence in the room, it made the moment between us seem much more dramatic than it should have been. "Do you want to talk about what happened?" he said. He opened the dishwasher like he had the right to be doing dishes in this house. He put the 3 glasses on the top shelf and then closed it. He dried his hands on a towel and dropped it on the counter while he waited for a response from me. I merely shook my head, uninterested in bringing it up again. He sighed and then said, "Merritt." I made eye contact with him, which was a terrible idea, because he dipped his head and looked at me apologetically, which made it impossible to hold on to any form of undeserved anger I held toward him. "I'm really sorry. I thought you were her."
I never would have kissed you had I known otherwise.
He appeared to be genuine in his apology, but as much as I tried to grasp the sincerity, I couldn't help but analyze that last part. I never would have kissed you had I known otherwise. Somehow that felt more like an insult than an apology, and I knew the whole thing was stupid, and it really was an honest mistake. Honor didn't know it happened, so I should have been able to laugh it off, but I couldn't. It was hard to laugh off something that affected me like it did. But I did my best to fake it.
That's fine, I said with a shrug. Really, it was such an awkward kiss anyway. I'm glad it was an accident because I was about 2 seconds away from slapping you.
Something in his expression faltered. I forced a smile as I turned and walked to my bedroom without looking back at him. That was the last time we spoke. We don't speak at breakfast. We don't speak at dinner. We don't speak when he's lingering in our living room, watching TV. But just because we don't speak doesn't mean I don't feel it every time he looks at me. I'm constantly trying to rein in my pulse because it makes me feel guilty that I'm even attracted to him. I don't like being envious of Honor. I try to tell myself that it isn't him I'm attracted to. It was the thought of a stranger desiring me enough to kiss me with as much passion as he kissed me that day. That's what I'm envious of. The idea of it all. It has nothing to do with Sagan or who he is as a person. I don't even know him enough to know if I would like him as a person. And I don't want to know that, which is precisely why I avoid him. But I do know that he doesn't seem to be Honor's type, and there's absolutely no chemistry between them. Or maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part. I've been doing my very best to tolerate the entire situation, but it's making me miserable. However, I have a feeling my tolerance won't be as intolerable now, because misery loves company, and the thing I am looking at is most definitely miserable. Despite it being after midnight, I'm holding open the front door, staring down into the frightened eyes of Wolfgang, the very dog that terrorized my father through many of my childhood years. What a delightful surprise. My father hasn't noticed, but I haven't been back to school for a while now, and my days and nights have been mixed up. I woke up a few minutes ago after everyone else had fallen asleep. I made my way to quarter one in search of food, but before I got to the kitchen, I heard what sounded like scratching against our double front doors. Since we have no animals of the four-legged variety, one would think my first instinct would have been to notify my father of a possible intruder. Instead, I immediately opened the door to investigate the matter myself. If my life were a scary movie, I'd be the first to die. Wolfgang is whimpering at my feet, covered in mud, shivering from the rain and, from the looks of it, terribly lost. There were several loud claps of thunder that shook the house and woke me up a few times when the storm began to roll through earlier tonight. He probably got spooked and started running until he ended up at the only other place he knows. I've never actually touched the dog before, since we were ordered to stay away from him as children. I reach my hand out, but I do so with hesitancy. Our father once told us he witnessed Wolfgang eat an entire Girl Scout. I realize now that it was a lie, of course, but with Wolfgang's visit tonight and the ominousness of the moment being heightened by the dark, I'm a bit nervous Wolfgang might assume I'm hiding Thin Mints in my pocket. But Wolfgang doesn't eat me. Not even partially. Quite the contrary, in fact. He licks me. It's a quick swipe of his tongue that catches my pinky and then releases it, as if it's more of a peace offering than an appetizer. I open the door a little wider, and Wolfgang recognizes it as the welcoming gesture it is, and he scurries inside. Immediately walks through quarter one and goes straight for the back door. He then proceeds to paw at the back door as if he wants access to the backyard. I've always assumed Wolfgang was an ignorant dog, so it surprises me he found his way back to his old stomping grounds. But it surprises me even more that he'd rather be outside in the backyard than here inside where it's dry. I would ask him why he's making such a poor choice, but he's a dog. I open the back door and Wolfgang whimpers once more and then pushes against the screen door until it opens, as if he's on a mission. I flip on the light to the backyard and watch as Wolfgang descends the steps and rushes through the rain to the doghouse that hasn't been moved or used since he was evicted by my father years ago. I want to warn Wolfgang that there could be spiders or other occupants who have since taken over his old residence, but he doesn't seem to mind. He disappears.